This is Sick Enough, Part 4, The Unmeasurables, aka the very real medical problems that modern medicine can't measure. In my quest to use objective evidence of body suffering in order to break through patients' denial and motivate them to seek eating disorder treatment, I have come upon many medical problems that cannot be measured. For instance, let's consider migraine headaches. Migraines are a particular type of headache that often starts with aura, where the vision or other senses become abnormal, and then progresses to a splitting headache that can last from several hours to days. Severity varies, ranging from a once-a-year occurrence to life-altering disability. There is no doubt that migraines are real, but there's no way to measure them. I can't biopsy brain cells to find the problem, and I can't perform a CAT scan or MRI during a migraine episode to establish severity or prove it's occurring. There's certainly no blood test. Doctors simply have to take the patient's word and narrative of symptoms as the sum total of data that can be collected and subsequently develop treatment plans from that. It turns out that many of these unmeasurable illnesses affect patients with eating disorders. They may not specifically result from the disorder, but they appear alongside it and make treatment more complicated, perhaps because patients with eating disorders have such strong mind-body connections. Many of these disorders worsen with stress, by all means including the stress of an eating disorder, and thus, to at least some degree, they can be considered a physical manifestation of emotional suffering. Part 4 will review irritable bowel syndrome, IBS, and associated conditions in Chapter 11, and postural orthostatic tachycardia syndrome, POTS, and associated conditions in Chapter 12. All of the unmeasurable problems I'll discuss in Part 4 directly obstruct the process of nutritional rehabilitation or eating disorder recovery work. Of course, a large number of medical problems can occur with a diagnosis of an eating disorder, but those I describe in this section can bring therapy, nutrition work, and life to a grinding halt because the body symptoms can be so intrusive. Suboptimal management of these medical problems risks further prolongation of the eating disorder, as well as alienation of patients from Western medicine altogether. I must note that I have no formal alternative medicine training at all. I'm sure there are great practitioners of it and crummy ones, just as there are in Western medicine. However, I now see too many patients with eating disorders who find themselves invisible to Western doctors. As a result, they may turn to alternative providers who put them on highly restrictive elimination diets, feeding them starvation-level amounts of bone broth for weeks while selling them handfuls of the provider's own personal brand of super expensive supplements that have not been quality checked. The eating disorder goes nuts, the bank account shrinks, and the original symptom still doesn't improve. One important concept that can interweave among all physical body symptoms, whether measurable or unmeasurable, is called somatic symptom disorder. This disorder is defined in the DSM-5 as body somatic symptoms lasting for at least 6 months that have been distressing or resulted in significant disruption or function and intrusively intense thoughts, feelings, and behaviors. This diagnosis can either bring a great clarity and relief to patients or feel frustratingly invalidating, depending on how it is communicated. Here's how I discuss it with patients. The mind-body connection is real and cannot always be perfectly explained or measured. Our emotional state affects our physical symptoms. When psychological stress is high and cannot be sufficiently ameliorated through therapy and self-care, it can manifest physically. Typically, stress will appear physically through body symptoms that already have some dysfunction. A former collegiate athlete who used to have back issues may find themselves with excruciating back pain during times of stress. Someone with lifelong digestive issues may find themselves doubled over with abdominal pain and nausea when overwhelmed. Seizures that correlate with no brainwave abnormalities on testing, called non-epileptic seizures, can develop during exhausting or conflict-filled experiences. None of these symptoms are made up, and to say they're all in your head is unhelpful and untrue. Patients may find themselves deeply distressed by physical symptoms, especially ones that apparently have no obvious medical cause. The key is that somatic symptom disorder usually accompanies complicated medical diagnoses, often unmeasurable, and a holistic approach that emphasizes the whole person, not just the medical or psychological that is needed. This leads me to the sobering reality of most of the diagnoses I will be describing. They're persistent and may not go away altogether, even with the best treatment. I try to set patients' expectations about this reality. Almost all of the unmeasurables described in Part 4 can incrementally improve over time, with setbacks, but they may not fully resolve. Some of my most humbling moments in my outpatient clinic have emerged from my inability to make meaningful inroads on some of these issues after the patient and I have both earnestly done everything we could think of to help.
Sick Enough, Chapter 11, Irritable Bowel Syndrome and Associated Conditions. Case, Emily. Emily is a 24-year-old cisgender Caucasian female who has been recovered from her eating disorder for 2 years. One of the first major triggers of her eating disorder was a very sensitive stomach. Starting in adolescence, she would experience multiple episodes of diarrhea a week and a distended, uncomfortable belly that was worse after eating. During particularly stressful times at school, this would be accompanied by nausea and occasional vomiting, and the diarrhea would get worse. Emily went to her pediatrician, who ran some blood tests and sent her to a gastroenterologist. The gastroenterologist was friendly but spent only 10 minutes with her. He said at the end, "Good news, it's irritable bowel syndrome. You just need to work on your anxiety." She felt like she'd been told she was making it up or it was all in her head. With symptoms still prominent, she and her parents saw a naturopath when she was 15, who recommended she eliminate gluten and dairy from her diet. Emily tried to do this, and her tummy felt a little bit better. But now she had the idea in her head that her stomach symptoms were caused by food, so she started reading online blogs. That reading was enough to make her cut many different carbohydrates out of her diet, as well as fats and sugars. She decided to try being vegetarian and vegan. Her parents watched with relatively little concern because their daughter had always been sensible, and after all, the naturopath's suggestion of eliminating gluten and dairy had made an important difference. They knew her tummy had been bothering her for years and figured she was trying to eat more healthily. Emily's increasingly restrictive food choices made her lose some weight, garnering positive feedback from friends and even teachers. She was startled by this because she had never had any negative body image and now wondered if everyone had noticed some problems she had not. As her weight fell, her diarrhea lessened, although her stomach still hurt after eating. Her mood turned dark, and she withdrew from friends. She slept poorly and felt anxious and exhausted all the time. Her schoolwork remained excellent, so her family attributed her various symptoms as being a typical teenager. Emily felt consistently deprived without many of her favorite foods. One night after everyone had gone to bed, she went into the kitchen and, almost without knowing what she was doing, began devouring leftovers. Stomach aching, she went to bed and actually slept well for the first time in months. This unspooled over the subsequent years into a cycle of restricting food groups, losing weight, then binging as if she could never satisfy herself as her weight rose again. A realization that she could vomit after a binge at age 20 made her eating patterns even more chaotic, and after 2 years, she realized that she had an eating disorder. Prior to that, she had always just thought she was reacting to her sensitive belly, and the fact that her weight wasn't abnormal made her think she didn't qualify for an eating disorder. Emily opened up to her parents, who were supportive, although somewhat skeptical about eating disorders in general. She established a team of a therapist and a dietitian, and over the course of 2 years, felt like she had put her eating disorder behind her. However, her belly symptoms persisted. While she tried to manage difficult days without acting on eating disorder impulses, she nonetheless still had painful abdominal distension multiple times a day after eating and periods of diarrhea, interspersed with new symptoms of painful constipation. Emily found it was hard to push a stool out, even though when it came out, it was often soft. She felt she wasn't fully empty after going to the bathroom and spent long hours on the toilet. Several times, after having no bowel movements for days, she actually had to put a finger in her rectum to manually remove hard stool and would have some bleeding after that. These symptoms, preceding her eating disorder and persistent after eating disorder recovery, finally prompted her to seek a doctor again. Historically, there have been two major categories of gastrointestinal problems, organic and functional. This use of organic doesn't refer to produce raised without pesticides. Rather, it means a type of problem that is structural and visible. Organic problems cause cells and organs to become abnormal, physically. You can see abnormalities on a biopsy or an X-ray. Functional problems, by contrast, refer to issues where the cells and structures are perfectly normal, but the ways they function are abnormal. Thus, on a biopsy, a blood test, or a radiographic film, they do not show up. This doesn't mean they are less severe, only that they are harder to diagnose and potentially harder to study in order to find treatments. Recently, the literature has shifted and now refers to functional gastrointestinal problems as disorders of gut-brain interaction. This is a much better and more scientifically accurate organizing construct. The Rome Foundation establishes diagnostic criteria to diagnose disorders of gut-brain interaction. Each new set of criteria takes a Roman numeral. The latest set of criteria, released in 2016, are called the Roman IV criteria. Irritable bowel syndrome is diagnosed when an individual has recurrent abdominal pain associated with defecation or a change in bowel habits, averaging at least 1 day a week over the preceding months. Irritable bowel syndrome, or IBS, comes in three subtypes: constipation, diarrheal, or mixed. My experience treating those with IBS is that patients have a strong mind-body connection. That is, when they are stressed or anxious, their abdominal symptoms worsen. However, this doesn't mean that patients imagine their IBS nor that can simply wish the symptoms away. They take again the example of a migraine headache, for which we know that stress can be a trigger. Once it started, the person cannot say, "Whoops, I'll put my feet up and rest. No need for this migraine." Once started, it's game on. The same is true with IBS. IBS is not a benign problem. It's not just IBS. IBS can be extraordinarily severe and debilitating, leading to profound malnutrition when someone has ceaseless nausea, vomiting, and diarrhea, for instance. IBS has been found to cause 8 to 22 days of missed workdays a year. Alternatively, it can be a relatively mild annoyance. However, because it's hard to make symptoms go away completely, regardless of severity, patients can be left frustrated and symptomatic. Rather than responding with compassion, doctors, anxious and perfectionists themselves, may feel the need to minimize the symptom as being not life-threatening, allowing them to manage their own feelings of inadequacy and frustration that they cannot ease the discomfort of their patient. Treatment of IBS. The treatment of IBS has many layers to it. The most important overarching theme is holistic care, meaning care of the whole person. I can prescribe all the right medications for someone's IBS, but unless they are concurrently working on getting good, consistent nutrition and rest, wielding stress management techniques, seeking regular self-care, and having their emotional needs met, the medicine won't work optimally. It would be like trying to put out a campfire while simultaneously squirting lighter fluid on it. Taking care of someone with IBS gives me the opportunity to remind them of the importance of their multidisciplinary team, validate the time and energy they are putting into their recovery work, and encourage them to take care of themselves and not just everyone else. A few medications are available for IBS constipation subtype, IBS-C. My experience is that every patient responds differently to each one, and I may have to try various medications until the best fit is found. Lubiprostone, 8 or 24 mcg by mouth twice a day with meals. Linaclotide, 145 or 290 mcg a day, more than 30 minutes before first meal. Or placanidide, 3 milligrams anywhere from daily to weekly, dosed any time of day. All are approved medications. The goal with each is to improve stool frequency. IBS diarrheal type, IBS-D, may be worsened by excessive bile acids produced in the liver and stored in the gallbladder. These bile acids may pull fluid into the intestinal lumen, much like a laxative, such as polyethylene glycol, with cause and worsen diarrhea. The first-line treatment for IBS-D, therefore, is a bile acid binder called Cholestipol, which comes in pill form. Since it is more palatable than a similar medication only available in a powder called Colestramine, I typically start patients on Cholestipol 1 gram daily or twice daily, 30 minutes before a meal, because Cholestipol is also a potent binder of medications. It must be dosed several hours from any other pills. Diclomine, given as 10 or 20 milligrams by mouth 4 times a day, is an antispasm medicine that can help with the pain of IBSD. Taking a medicine 4 times a day, of course, is also a pain, figuratively. Hyposcyamine, 0.125 to 0.25 milligram by mouth 3 or 4 times a day as needed, is also an antispasm medicine. I've seen patients on this latter medicine develop psychiatric symptoms due to an anticholinergic effect, while others find this their medicine of choice. There are currently no medicines for IBS mixed subtype. I cannot count how many times I've seen a patient with IBS on the wrong class of medications. All the IBS-C medicines can cause diarrhea, while all the IBS-D medications can cause constipation. None of these medications are proven in the context of congruent malnutrition. Many patients ask me if they should follow a meal plan low in dietary fermentable carbohydrates, including fermentable oligodimonosaccharides or polyols for their IBS. The data seem to indicate that a low FODMAP diet can help reduce symptoms in individuals with IBS, particularly diarrheal subtype. Strictly following a low FODMAP diet, however, means avoiding many fruits, vegetables, dairy-containing foods, and legumes. The list is long and complicated. Designed to be used as a brief elimination period followed by a slow reintroduction phase to see what food the body does and doesn't tolerate. The low FODMAP diet can nonetheless represent a distractingly restrictive set of food rules. I just cannot recommend it for patients with eating disorders. Small intestine bacterial overgrowth. Many patients who have IBS still have some symptoms of distension and discomfort even when they are taking good care of themselves and are on a good prescription medication. They find themselves wondering where to turn next. In such cases, my next consideration is usually small intestinal bacterial overgrowth, SIBO. It turns out that the human body may have as many as 100 trillion bacteria living on or in us, necessary for our good health and perfectly symbiotic with their human host. A healthy small intestine has relatively few bacteria, however. When bacteria grow in the small intestine, they can cause significant GI upset. SIBO occurs in more than half of patients with IBS. Its manifestations range from mild symptoms that overlap with IBS, like bloating, distension, pain, to severe enterotopy, meaning dysfunction of the intestine, that causes malabsorption, simulating celiac disease. In extreme cases of SIBO, patients may also develop a relative pancreatic insufficiency. The problem is that when there are too many bacteria in the small intestine, they begin to ferment digesting food, releasing either methane or hydrogen gas in the process. While the science continues to evolve on SIBO, it appears that the disorder can disrupt epithelial tight junctions, where two intestinal cells meet, increasing small intestinal permeability to endotoxins. Endotoxins are molecules found on bacteria that are harmless inside the intestine, but if they cross into the bloodstream, they can elicit a strong immune inflammatory response. In terms of diagnosing SIBO, Breath testing is the most common test, although both false positives and false negatives can occur. The idea is that gases produced by bacteria in the small intestine will cross the intestinal wall and enter the bloodstream, go to the lungs, and be exhaled. A fairly strict set of guidelines exists to make these tests more accurate, and consensus guidelines have been developed on how to perform and interpret these tests for optimal clinical interpretation. Because testing requires dietary alterations and fasting, it is not appropriate to subject patients fragile in their eating disorder recovery work to this process. In the right clinical context, I will skip the test and simply offer a course of SIBO treatment to see if patients feel better. SIBO treatment. So, what are SIBO treatments? First, it is important to note that SIBO is not easily eradicated and it can reoccur easily. Historically, a course of a non-absorbed antibiotic called rifaximin, 550 milligrams three times a day for 14 days, is prescribed. While this is perfectly reasonable as a treatment, I try to use antibiotics as sparingly as possible, as not to A, kill off good bacteria, and B, contribute to bacterial antibiotic resistance. As a Western medicine doctor, here's a place where I've had to step out of my comfort zone. I was never trained in the use of herbal supplements, in part because they aren't regulated, and thus I have no assurance either that what's in the bottle is supposed to be in the bottle, without any hidden additives, or that the recommended dosing is consistent with desired outcomes. However, I firmly believe that there is a role for supplements in SIBO treatment. Specifically, a well-done randomized controlled trials showed that two different herbal remedies were non-inferior to rifaximin, which means they have worked at least as well for SIBO eradication. The advantage is that they may disrupt the normal gut microflora less than rifaximin. One regimen tested, FC-cytal and dysbiocide from Biotics, can be ordered online. If patients do not respond to the Biotics regimen, I try the other regimen from the study. Metagenetics Candibactin AR and Candibactin BR, which is also available online. For both regimens, the dosing is capsules of each twice a day for four weeks. I often add in a third supplement that specifically targets methane-producing bacteria called Atherton. While no randomized controlled trial exists, a very small case study by the doctor who invented it showed good efficiency of Atrantil improving IBS symptoms. When I cannot rely on the medical literature for validation of a treatment, I turn to trusted clinicians. To that end, the best gastroenterologist I know regularly uses supplements in her practice, so I feel secure in doing so with my patients. Antril is taken as two capsules 2 to 3 times a day with food for 2 weeks, and then 2 capsules a day maintenance. Patients can find bloating worsens transiently around the 2-week mark as bacteria die off, then resolves. Pelvic floor dysfunction. If IBS medications and SIBO eradication don't sufficiently resolve symptoms, I consider dysfunction of the pelvic floor muscles. These are a network of small muscles that hold up the uterus in females, bladder, and bowel. The function and sensation of the rectum, vagina, and urethra have everything to do with the pelvic floor. Cycles of dieting that cause muscle mass loss may also leave the pelvic floor weak and functioning improperly. Big muscles like our biceps will rehab themselves naturally after malnutrition because we use them normally all the time. By contrast, those who have lost muscle mass in the delicate muscles of their pelvic floor may not regain normal, balanced strength. This is especially true if a patient is always trying to push out hard stool or always trying to hold in diarrhea. Exercising excessively and putting high pressure on the abdominal muscles. In addition, chronic stress, high anxiety, and the drive to hold a stomach in to create a flat stomach can lead to overall high muscle tone and tension. There are several ways the pelvic floor can function improperly. In high tone pelvic floor dysfunction, for example, the muscles are constantly contracted. Neither stool nor gas can pass through the rectum and anus easily. Pain with penetrative intercourse, pelvic exams, or tampon use can also occur. On the other side of the spectrum, pelvic floor weakness might cause a person to have trouble with urine and stool incontinence. The nerve endings in the rectum, which are responsible for the sensation of needing to move one's bowels and of retained stool, can also malfunction. Finally, one muscle might try to move rectal contents forward while another muscle spasms and halts progress. This is called pelvic floor dyssynergia. The Rome IV criteria diagnose pelvic floor dyssynergia, meaning disturbance of muscular coordination, when someone has to strain to pass a stool, feels unable to empty the rectum, or has difficulty relaxing to evacuate stool. Pelvic floor dysfunction can be diagnosed by a test called anocreal manometry, in which the technician inserts a soft pressure monitoring balloon into the rectum, and the patient is asked to push, contract, or describe the sensation they experience. A skilled pelvic floor physical therapist, alternatively, can also do a detailed exam, both internal and external, and establish which, if any, muscles are malfunctioning. The physical therapist designs a plan for the patient to follow, ultimately resulting in relief from a wide variety of symptoms. Pelvic floor dysfunction and IBS. How do the pelvic floor and IBS intersect when it comes to symptoms of bloating and distension? Bloating means the sensation the patient has of uncomfortable abdominal fullness, unrelated to the stomach being full after a meal. Distension, on the other hand, refers to actual physical expansion of the abdominum. A study found that patients with constipation, but not IBS, have double the bloating and distension of the general population. However, remarkably, those with IBS-C have a 14 times higher incidence of bloating and distension. While theories vary for what causes the distension, one reasonable theory is that impaired gas transit may be responsible. It turns out that pelvic floor dysfunction may contribute to impaired gas transit. In a study, patients with abdominal distension received anorectal manometry. They exhibited high resting and with effort anal sphincter pressures and a prolonged balloon expulsion time. The good news is that expert PT and biofeedback are highly effective in treating pelvic floor dysfunction. These treatments reduce pelvic pain, tailbone pain, pain with penetrative intercourse, urinary incontinence, constipation, and stool incontinence. Given that the therapy is quite intimate, patients with a history of sexual trauma, those with heightened modesty, or those with intense anxiety when unclothed, have to consider the benefits and risks of engaging in PT. If they choose to proceed, they should plan to communicate clearly with their physical therapist, go very slowly in the work, and plan to process emotions that emerge with their therapist. The gut microbiota. A lot of my patients ask me whether taking probiotics is useful. The answer is maybe. To really review probiotics, though, we have to step back and take a brief look at the microbiome gut-brain connection, especially as it relates to eating disorders. This line of scientific inquiry is fascinating and potentially groundbreaking. To define it a few terms, microbiome refers to bacterial DNA, while microbiota refers to the bacteria themselves. A microbiome gut-brain connection begins when bacteria in the colon consume food and release byproducts that then cross into the human bloodstream, influencing the hypothalamic pituitary adrenal axis. Increasingly, it's looking like our psychological well-being is substantially influenced by the bacteria that live in our gut. Amazingly enough, in terms of the sheer quantity of DNA contained in a single person, 99% of what's in us is microbial. For every human cell, there are 10 bacteria. Scientists are coming to understand that our microbiome may have a direct causal influence on a wide variety of health outcomes. Let me offer a few astounding examples. When identical twins, one of whom has multiple sclerosis, provide stool samples, and these are introduced into the intestinal systems of mice, the mice that get bacteria from the twin with MS have a higher incidence of autoimmune diseases. Identical twins have far more similar microbiota than siblings or unrelated individuals, even if they live far away from each other and have different environmental exposures, showing that there is a heritable aspect to the bacteria that eventually live in and on us. Health problems like the metabolic syndrome, high cholesterol levels, high blood pressure, and high blood sugar have been associated with having specific populations of bacteria in the gut, where one twin has the syndrome and another doesn't, suggesting that some bacteria may play a causal role in developing the syndrome. As a final example, Malawane twin toddlers were studied over time. In some cases, one twin developed a particular kind of malnutrition called washikor, where the belly becomes very proburnant. The exact cause of this malnutrition remains unknown, although it appears to be related to protein, calorie malnutrition, and other environmental insults, resulting in abdominal fluid retention and an enlarged liver. Stool samples from the twin with this kind of malnutrition and the twin without showed significant differences in their microbiomes. When stool samples from this type of malnutrition were fed the standard Malawian diet, the mice who received kwashiorkor bacteria became significantly more malnourished. How does this translate to those with eating disorders? Associations have now clearly been proven among appetite, metabolism, weight, and the gut microbiome. Studies have now conclusively determined that those with anorexia nervosa have a far less diverse gut microbiome than controls. And they have a particular deficit in certain bacterial types. Interesting associations have been made between this observation and psychiatric symptoms. For instance, those with anorexia nervosa lack normal quantities of bacteria that produce butyrate, and low butyrate levels correlate with higher anxiety. Studies have also found that gut microbiome directly impacts intestinal motility. Alteration of the gut microbiome may be one way in which the body slows its metabolism during starvation. We still don't know exactly why patients with anorexia nervosa can eat such high caloric meal plans to gain weight during recovery, but preliminary research suggests that this may have something to do with the microbiome too. Probiotics. All we have to do to cure disease is run out and buy a couple bottles of probiotics, right? Not so fast. People do not have tracts of unpopulated colon just waiting for the right probiotic. We're all fully colonized at all times. That means probably the probiotics we take pass right through us without meaningfully changing the composition of our intestinal microbiota. Actual studies continually fail to prove that taking probiotics works. For instance, in a common issue such as yeast infections in women, the hypothesis is that normal vaginal microbiota is disrupted such that yeast overgrows. Probiotics should really help, but the data aren't convincing. Let's take another problem, such as Clostridium difficile colitis, known as C. diff. C. diff occurs when antibiotic use diminishes good bacteria, resulting in the overgrowth of one particularly bad bacterium. This is a dreadful, mostly hospital-transmitted infectious diarrhea that is very hard to treat and can be deadly. You'd think that probiotics during antibiotic administration or after a bout of C. diff would help prevent disease or reoccurrence. However, the data are still mixed. Interestingly, a proven treatment for recurrent C. diff is to infuse healthy stool from a stool donor via colonoscopy or enema. While oral probiotics don't clearly work, getting a full bacterial load from healthy stool does help the colon recolonize and resist disease. A top group of microbiome researchers once told me that they themselves don't take probiotics. They said that the science just isn't there. They likened being offered a probiotic to a doctor saying to a patient, "Here, would you like this medicine?" "Well, what is the medicine?" "Oh, it's just a medicine. We're not sure what it does." "Well, what are we treating?" "We're not sure, but would you like the medicine?" True confession, I do recommend probiotics for my patient with IBS and SIBO. After 1 month of supplement eradication of SIBO, I encourage patients to start on a daily probiotic. My current top two are VSL number 3, which can be prescribed through a pharmacy, improving the odds that it stays cold enough to remain active as it has to be refrigerated, or Florastrol. There are some data to support this. A review article noted that probiotics cannot prevent SIBO, but they can help eradicate it and improve symptoms of pain and bloating, although not stool frequency. Ultimately, everyone's experience of these is different. Some patients absolutely swear by probiotics, and others have never found them helpful. or get more bloated with them. That probably emerges from a combination of genetic variability causing different responses, as well as placebo effect. Case resolution, Emily. Emily's new doctor refers her to a gastroenterologist for a diagnostic colonoscopy just to be sure that no measurable medical problem is presenting atypically. The colonoscopy is normal. Emily knows not to be invalidated by that small result because she and her doctor talked in advance about the complicated relationship between gut and the brain, and she understood the low probability that colonoscopy would reveal anything abnormal. That rule out complete, Emily's doctor makes the diagnosis of IBS mixed subtype. Emily is then offered SIBO testing as well as a referral to a pelvic floor physical special therapist. Emily's breath testing comes back positive, so she starts taking FC-cidal, dysbiocide, and atrantil for a month. There are an annoying number of capsules to take, but she manages. After about 3 weeks, her distension is noticeably better, and her stools are a little more regular. The pelvic floor physical therapist diagnoses her with pelvic floor dyssynergia, and they begin meeting weekly. At first, Emily isn't sure that therapy is helping. However, about 8 weeks later, while taking a lower dose of maintenance astranil, and on a VSL number 3 probiotic, she realizes she hasn't had distracting abdominal symptoms for an entire week. Yes, she is still somewhat bloated at times, but she is spending much less time in the bathroom. Yes, when stressed, her symptoms worsen. But there are more good days, and her worst day now. is better than her best day before. The dog in the street. I recall one of my former patients who was overlooking a busy street from her hospital window. She saw a dog wander into the road. Fortunately, all the cars slowed and stopped so as not to hit it, but no one got out of their vehicle. It was a standoff, with the dog looking scared and frozen in place, and the cars waiting for it to move. My patient said that's how she felt sometimes in her recovery. As if she were the dog, everyone stopping and staring, but no one getting out to help. I told her I loved this metaphor and took it further with her. I reminded her that the poor dog was so terrified that he had no idea which way to turn in that moment. Similarly, patients who feel helpless and stuck in moving forward in recovery may not be able to be self-directed and know what to do next. They're likely exhausted, malnourished, anxious, depressed, and frozen in place, like the dog. I can't expect patients currently engaging in eating disorder behaviors to think to themselves as if they were the dog in the street. Ah, I see. I know just what to do here. I need to turn around, walk back to the grassy, safe side of the street, and ignore these huge cars bearing down on me. They don't have to know what to do next. I tell them, here's what you can do. You can let your team carry you off the street without scratching or biting us. You don't have to proactively seek and accept a solution, but you can choose not to resist. By compassionately seeing themselves as the dog in the street, they can let the team help and guide them until they are out of the scariest moments and can start connecting insight with action themselves. Individuals with an eating disorder may not be able to joyfully accept recommended treatment, but they can choose not to resist. That concludes the reading of Sick Enough, Chapter 11, Irritable Bowel Syndrome and Associated Conditions.